For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder. The UN Conference on Sustainable Development closed in Rio de Janeiro yesterday, billed by the UN as a once-in-a-generation chance to put the global economy onto an environmentally sustainable track. The three-day Earth Summit brought together some 50,000 people, including 130 heads of state, business leaders, scientists, and non-governmental groups. The conference was to assess past progress and agree on goals for the future, but ended with a non-binding declaration that many observers view as falling far short of expectations or even preordained by the United Nations' embrace of what critics call a corporate agenda. We're joined live from Rio today by Maria Ivanova, an international relations and environmental policy scholar specializing in global governance and environmental sustainability. She is assistant professor of global governance at the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and also co-directs the Center for Governance and Sustainability there. I'd like to welcome Maria Ivanova. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you join us, especially the day after the conference. I wonder if we could start with a little bit of context here. This UN conference comes on the 20th anniversary of the landmark 1992 Earth Summit, also held in Rio. What was the significance of that first Earth Summit, and how does this summit compare to that one?
It's a pleasure being on the air, Amy, exactly the day after the Rio Earth Summit now, also dubbed Rio Plus 20. But Rio in 1992 was not the first Earth Summit. This conference also is Stockholm Plus 40, because the first UN conference on the global environment was held in 1972 in Stockholm from June 5th to the 14th. Then every 20 and or 10 years, we have had another big international conference. So the first one was in Stockholm, and that is when the foundations for global environmental governance were laid down. Now, 40 years later, we are looking back and trying to reform some of the institutions that were created at that time. One of the big agenda items here was institutional framework for sustainable development and the reform of the UN Environment Program, which was created in Stockholm. And then the next big conference was in Rio in 1992, and then after that Johannesburg in 2002, and now we have 2012, the second so-called Rio Earth Summit, so Rio plus 20. What is different at this point is qualitatively the spirit was quite different from that in Rio, because if you remember the early 90s, the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the world had a new sense of optimism. This is when heads of state came with high hopes for a completely different geopolitical situation. And I think 20 years later, that spirit has been dampened quite a bit. However, at the same time, we see an incredible proliferation of activities, of actions at the local level around the world, which so far have not been connected. And I think that this conference, at this summit, people saw a different way of connecting to each other across the world, across boundaries, and that perhaps is the source of optimism, while at the intergovernmental level, pessimism really reigned during this meeting.
So you're saying the success was actually on the part of the non-governmental actors at this conference. Is that what you're saying, or that there was more accord or more opportunities to solve problems on that level than on the governmental level?
Yes, there were two parallel feelings among people here at the conference, and you could see it coming in and out of the conference hall. If you were part of the intergovernmental negotiations and following that process, at times it was depressing when governments were negotiating on text that has been agreed 40 years ago, 20 years ago, and 10 years ago, reconfirming the same commitments without really setting any timelines, any targets of when these commitments would actually be implemented and fulfilled. And so that leads to significant depression in the spirit. At the same time, if you go to side events, the so-called side events here, when non-governmental organizations or businesses or universities, in our case, gather their constituencies and say, well, what are you doing where you live, and how does your activity connect to others across the world? There's a much more fervent sense, not only of a need to do something, but also of the feeling that, yes, we are progressing and we are doing something in the locality where we live.
There was also an alternative summit, the Cupulo de Povos, or the People's Summit, happening at the same time.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And this has always been the case. This has always been the case. Since 1972, at the Stockholm Conference, there was a parallel People's Summit there as well, where non-governmental organizations gathered. And indeed, it was the first UN conference that allowed for that to happen. So the environmental movement, these environmental conferences, have created the space, the institutional space, but also the intellectual space, for these alternative summits to go alongside the intergovernmental ones.
Well, is it fair to say, for listeners who aren't familiar with even what sustainable development means or what the struggles are for economic development in other countries, is it fair to say that even the term sustainable development kind of papers over a certain tension between economic development goals, which might be seen as industrialization, and on the one hand, and environmental goals on the other? And with that in mind, does sustainable development mean different things to different groups? I wonder if you could lay out the divisions for us between mm-hmm. different blocks of countries, developed countries like the US mm-hmm. and Europe, mm-hmm. industrializing countries using coal, etc., like China and countries like Brazil, and poor countries in Asia, Latin America, and Africa.
Yes, you're absolutely right. We have the term sustainable development came around in the late 1980s in preparation for the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. And it was an attempt to bring together these three dimensions, the environmental dimension, the social dimension, and the economic dimension. And at the time, they were conceptualized as pillars. And you would often hear the narratives of the three pillars of sustainable development: the environment, the economy, and the social pillar. And I find that language somewhat misleading and confusing, because the environment is not a separate pillar. The environment is the foundation upon which life on Earth depends. We have built human societies within the environment. And then within our societies, we have economies. And so sustainable development was an attempt to bring those together. But you're absolutely right that over the years, different groups, different constituencies have put different meanings in the concept. And it does mean different things to different people. However, if we were to define it simply, and I will give you a definition that really appeals to me, and it's not of sustainable development per se, but of a somewhat different concept that is closely related: human security. And the Japanese government introduced that term a few years ago, and the UN Development Program has worked with it quite a bit. And to me, it really articulates what sustainable development is, and that is the ability of humans to lead healthy and productive lives in harmony with nature. The ability of humans to lead healthy and productive lives in harmony with nature. And it's not that difficult to conceptualize, but it's very difficult to implement. And so you're right that in different parts of the world, in developing countries and developed countries, you would have different trajectories towards that goal. And some will be based on extractive economies. Others will be based on tourism or different assets of the particular country. But if you keep in mind that overall framework and that principle that humans need to be able to lead healthy and productive lives in harmony with nature, then that provides you almost a social and environmental contract within which you can operate as a society. What is strikingly different now is that we realize that our borders cannot really present the natural state of affairs, and that we cannot lead those lives only confined by national boundaries. So the planet is now much smaller, not physically but socially, because we can communicate with people around the world almost instantaneously. I mean, I'm really here in Rio now and grateful for the opportunity to speak with you and to your audience in Boston, where I come from right now, where I'm based right now, and where I will be in a few days. But this new type of connectivity, I think, is something that we have to use much more systematically and consciously to be able to build that sustainable future that that we have to create.
I'd like to address some of the criticisms of this conference. The conference was to address proposals for a so-called green economy, and that term has come under fire from environmental groups as they allege a thinly disguised program of or agenda, a corporate agenda. They call it a corporate hijacking of UN environmental leadership by private interests, especially, for example, multinational corporations. And they point to the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, and they argue that in fact the theme of this, the proposals that are being aired at the conference, some of them that come under this green economy rubric, if you will, are coming from corporate or multinational corporations. Could you address some of those criticisms for us?
Yes. The interesting thing about the green economy concept is that it's being criticized from both sides. Some, as you articulated, criticize it for being a corporate scheme, while others criticize it for being an environmentalist scheme, for allowing environmentalism to reign supreme in the world and subjugate developing countries' economies in particular. So my personal opinion is that neither of those is right in and of itself. And we cannot live on this planet without an economy. Every day we consume, and the way we consume needs to be much more conscious. And the green economy is a concept that aims to, again, reformulate that sustainable development paradigm that we started our conversation with, to integrate it into the contemporary political realities. Because, I mean, we have to face it, capitalism now does reign supreme around the world, and often it is without the necessary checks and balances to allow that harmonious development in an economic, environmental, and social sense. And to me, the way I understand the green economy is the attempt to actually recreate that balance. Yes, we do need to have economies, but those economies need to be in harmony with nature. How do you create that practically is what this conference set out to imagine. And where it has fallen short is in that imagination part. But at the same time, it did open the door to conversations then around the world on what does that concept mean and how can we fill it with meaning, and we being all those different constituencies. Because as the Brazilian Environment Minister Isabela Teixeira here articulated, we live in a democracy and we have to live with each other, and we have to articulate our interests. And so if it was a really incredible situation here where environmentalists protested against the forest code weakening in Brazil, and she challenged them back in one of these side events and said, when you live in a democracy, these things can certainly happen, but you have to elect officials who will protect the environmental interests in the political system. And so the green economy is a new concept, but it's based on the original reasoning that environment and development are two sides of the same coin. What I think needs to happen now is to fill that concept with new meaning that engages both the private sector and other non-governmental organizations and governments also around the world.
I think the concern, to be fair to some of these critics, is that somehow it's not just a question of giving corporations, say, a financial incentive to engage or regulate corporations. I think the idea is to give them a financial incentive to engage in environmentally sustainable practices, right, instead of regulating them, and that somehow the amount of government influence on the UN has become very prominent. For example, just even mm-hmm. this conference itself, right, of the $250 million or so that Brazil planned or did spend on the conference, most of it came from a special government fund, but about $10 million each was contributed by several corporations. I think that Vale, Electrobras, and Petrobras, which is a state oil mm-hmm, company. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I think the concern is that, as is the concern elsewhere in the world, in the United States, for example, the influence, the way that money turns into power. And I guess the question I'd last like to ask you is, since you do specialize in this idea of global governance and in the United Nations mm-hmm. and the United Nations Environment Program, has it been sidelined to some extent by the entry of powerful business interests or powerful government delegations that represent them, for example? Or what's your sense of what's happening in the UN and whether it can be independent of this?
That's a very good question, and I have to say it really begs for more empirical data and empirical research. You know, as a scholar, it's difficult for me to say it's one way or the other if I'm not certain in my data. But when you mention financial incentives versus regulation, I have to say, you know, personally, I don't think financial incentives should displace regulation. And if anything, the environmental sphere, the environmental issues have shown us that voluntarism is insufficient. There are not many environmental problems I can think of that have been solved voluntarily. And business is a very powerful actor. But business is a very powerful actor when it is reined in, so to speak, by the government, when there are certain regulatory frameworks within which business has to operate. For example, one of our most serious global problems before climate change really came to the fore was the depletion of the ozone layer. And it actually is perhaps the only global environmental problem that we have solved. And it was not solved by voluntary action. It was solved by regulation at an international level.
Back when regulation was popular.
Well, I don't know if it was popular or not, but the United States was a leader in the 1980s in regulating the industry. But even the threat of regulation prompted industry to find substitutes for the ozone-depleting substances. So we cannot move We cannot, we should not be dismantling regulation. It doesn't mean that we should not put in place financial incentives. Absolutely. I mean, those need to be in place. But you cannot only have one side of that equation. In terms of the power of business interests in the United Nations, again, it is a contentious issue. You know, how much is too much of business engagement or business interest? And the question that governments are asking themselves that those of us that are not in government are reacting against is, are these government delegations representing the business interests in their own countries, or are they representing the citizens' interests? And there certainly is a leaning or a reality in the world that more and more governments do get captured by a lot of business interests. However, I think that's why it's really important to be working with businesses, but also at businesses. And that is why this non-governmental fervor and this push for greater transparency, reporting, and these are some of the issues that were discussed here, and that will move forward, is sustainability reporting by industries. And there are leaders in the business world who are pushing for a convention, international convention on sustainability reporting. And that will change the game when all of the industries are required to report on their sustainability practices. I think it will change the sustainability practices themselves. But just to recap again, I think like the Brazilian environment minister said, it's really important that people elect government officials who will be defenders of environmental regulations and who will be champions and leaders in this field rather than being captured by other interests.
Well, there too we have the power of money in the electoral process.
You're absolutely right.
So, yeah.
And that I don't know what to do about that. I really don't know.
It appears to be a linked problem, I guess, is what I'm sort of getting at here. To get back to the actual conference, though, there was, again, a lot of disappointment in this non-binding declaration. I think there was a hope for at least an articulation of agreed upon goals for the future that never came about. But also there were some creative proposals that, as some people say, hit the cutting room floor. Among those were proposals to eliminate government subsidies on fossil fuels, which I guess was recommended in a number of well-received reports. Annually, governments give $1 trillion annually. Governments give $1 trillion in tax breaks and subsidies to oil, gas, coal, and other fossil fuels. That was one. There was the hope for the United Nations or the government leaders there to recognize the human right to access to water. And that was a particularly interesting issue, given the move towards privatization by some of these big water companies. Mm-hmm. And then the last one was what happened with the gender equality issue, that gender equality has been recognized as imperative, necessary for sustainable development as a piece of it. But the final declaration removed any reference to reproductive rights under pressure from the Vatican. So, which, of course, allows, I guess there are, I'm not sure exactly how that's linked to the environment, but it's certainly linked to women's autonomy. Did you have that sense also that a lot of good ideas actually didn't make it? And what did make it in the end? What made it into this document? Was there anything that people could take home or governments could take home of value?
Well, these documents have interesting lives. We have grown to expect those documents to set the terms of reference for our multilateral interactions. And this is what we used to do in the last about 20 years ago. And perhaps the last big conference where these things happened was Rio in 92, when the Convention on Climate Change was adopted, the Convention on Biodiversity was adopted, and the Convention on to Combat Desertification was adopted. It all happened in Rio in 1992. Interestingly, the Brazilian newspapers around the time also had this sense of despair and said nothing has come out of this meeting. It's too weak. The verdict that conference was successful only came years later when we look back and say, oh, look at what we accomplished at that time. So I sincerely hope that we're not going to be looking misty-eyed backwards and saying, oh, look how much we accomplished in Rio in 2012. There is certainly this, I wouldn't say progression, perhaps it is a regression toward weaker legally binding documents. And there were people here at the conference, especially young people, who were protesting, and it was a very, very vivid protest of young people in the courtyard of the conference center walking backwards as a symbol that we are regressing in our international commitment. So they would gather and they just walk backwards through that yard. So you're absolutely right that there were hopes and there were aspirations towards some stronger document that would articulate goals and that would have targets and that would be much more concrete, and that did not happen. What did happen, however, was this commitment to a process to create the goals that you are alluding to that are now known as Sustainable Development Goals. At the moment, we have at the UN the Millennium Development Goals, a set of 8 global goals that articulate aspirations of reducing poverty, of reducing maternal mortality and children's mortality, and improving health, and also attaining environmental sustainability. But those goals expire in 2015. And so what governments have committed to here is to not only renew those goals, but actually reframe them as global sustainable development goals. And you heard this acronym SDGs here quite a lot during the meeting. So I honestly think, as weak as that is, it does set a process forward. Because, I mean, let's face it, governments, 190-plus governments could not come together and agree on a set of 5, 10, or even 15 goals and say we will attain those. What governments' role is to say we want to see those goals, and now let the experts actually articulate them, develop them, tell us why we should be attaining them, in what time frame, and how. In terms of other concrete issues that were in the final outcome document, what people are talking about is the progress on ocean protection, and there are several countries here who have been very active in pushing forward for greater international commitment and protection of the ocean. And a lot of the Caribbean countries, a lot of the small island developing states, and there is language in the document that again opens up a process. I think the main point is that this final document did not create anything concrete on any of the issues, but it created new processes. And this is the essence of the UN, is we start a new process toward a new goal, or hopefully even a new vision. And also this outcome document is extremely comprehensive. I mean, it covers so many different issues. And if we think realistically, you know, how concrete can you be on everything coming, you know, starting from oceans to desertification, climate change, biodiversity, biosafety issues, women's rights, women reproductive rights, and you're right, that language did get dropped out, and a lot of women were protesting here at the conference.
Maria, I'm afraid we're going to have to end it. We're just about out of time. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. It was a pleasure talking with you, Amy.
It was a great pleasure. I'm glad you could join us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Maria Ivanova, who is an international relations and environmental policy scholar. She's assistant professor of global governance at the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies and also co-directs the Center for Governance and Sustainability. She joined us direct from Rio. For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder.